They called you just to, the mayor's office called to advise?
No, my legal advisor was there. They had been in touch with him. He's now Chief Justice of the Court of Appeals. That's Robert Danhoff.
Okay.
And he called me because the mayor's office had called him, and he was in touch with the mayor's office. And they had assured him that they thought they could handle the disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
They had handled one earlier, you know, mm-hmm. in the year. And so they thought they could handle this one. And then it wasn't until the afternoon that he called and indicated that things were much more serious than they realized, and therefore they'd like our help, the mm-hmm. state's help. That came in the afternoon, and he was the one calling. The mayor, who had arrived there in the morning, had requested the assistance of 200 state troopers. Well, they just asked for the assistance of the state, the National Guard. Mm-hmm. There was no indication of a number.
Mm-hmm.
Just
okay.
At 3:05, word was received that 360 troopers were at the 8 Mile Road Armory awaiting transportation. That's right. At 4:20, the Kavanaugh requested the aid of the National Guard troops. Well, if they requested 200 ahead of the time, they didn't request them at me. My recollection is that when I was asked to make the National Guard available.
Mm-hmm.
It's true that there were troopers at the armory, but the bulk of the troops were up at the railing on summer training. And that was one reason it took time to get the troops down here, because they had to be transported from railing down. Mm-hmm. There were only these few that were in the army at the time. Let's see. And by 5:25, the first contingent of guardsmen began to arrive at Central High School staging area. 50 minutes later, Governor Romney authorized their activation. And by 6:57, guardsmen began to appear on the first streets. Well, I had no way of checking those times and all of it. At 4 p.m., police headquarters received a manpower report from Kiefer Command that 156 policemen were committed in the fill area. An additional 100 were detailed, and so on. The next few hours, however, the path arrived was westward. At 4 p.m., the first report of arson, and so on. 5 p.m., came from current reports of broken windows. 5 minutes later, reports of looting. 2,000 looters at 7:45 p.m. Mayor Kavanaugh issued a proclamation placing the city under curfew between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. I don't know whether he issued that or whether I did. I think I did. But my recollection is I issued the proclamation on curfew. This proclamation was broadcast via police radio 805. The reports of continued looting and so on. Conditions of the streets were in the highway. They can report that two battalions of guardsmen were brought to Detroit. 800 from Grand Rapids and Flint. Well, that's not quite correct either, because they had to get there all up in railing, as far as I recall. And had to come down from railing. They may well have been troopers from Grand Rapids or Flint that were up there, but we had to get them down from railing, that's why. Took time to get them down. At 9:07, the first confirmed report of a sniper fire directed police helicopter was received. By 9:35, reports of a sniper fire directed firemen were received. And so on. During the next few hours, the riot continued going intensity from 11 p.m. to midnight. Incidents of looting and arson were reported. And the police logged over 900 calls and so on, over 300 fires. Had been set the more than 40 raging out of control at 1 minute before midnight. Governor Romney, who arrived at police headquarters early afternoon, declared Detroit, Hamtramck, and Highland Park to be in a state of public emergency, but the worst was yet to come. Under the governor's proclamation, the mayor's curfew issued some 4 hours earlier was reaffirmed. Well, maybe it was reaffirmed by all persons were to be off the streets between 9 p.m. and 5:30. No alcohol. States for it. In the aftermath of that, I discovered that Rahm's legal advisors had neglected to attach appropriate penalties for violations of the proclamation of subsequent arrest made under Danhoff would know about that either. That's a detail I don't know about. Subsequent arrests made under this provision were thrown out by the courts. The proclamation did have this effect, however, providing a qualitative basis for police action and dealing with furor in the streets. Shortly after midnight, July 24th, Fire Chief Flynn called for assistance from suburban fire departments. Within the next 72 hours, over 90 pieces of fire equipment were responded. At 12:25, the first riot death was recorded. Minor subsequent interpretations, which apparently stressed eager participation in the riot and so on. I can't comment all the details, but
sure.
I know the general pattern of what was happening, burning, looting, continued. This pretty story of Clueless to Washington began to unfold. Let's see, this is... In the aftermath of the riot, this episode was debated, disputed, and decried, but very few facts emerged to shed light on precisely what took place. The facts are not very comforting. But they do reveal, in a rather tragic fashion, that world, which is politics and government bureaucracy. During the initial hours of the riot, the Democratic mayor of Detroit and the Republican governor of Michigan managed to work together with rather remarkable effectiveness. Both had been on the scene since the early hours of the disorder. Kavanaugh arrived at police headquarters shortly after 10 a.m. and Romney early Saturday afternoon. Kavanaugh's request for state assistance were acted upon with some promise by Romney, avoiding the tragic mistakes and coordination between municipal and state offices which state offices made during the 1943 riot. According to a period of only a few hours elapsed during the request by the mayor for state troopers and guardsmen and their commitment by the governor. At 3 a.m. on July 24th, Kavanaugh and Romney announced they had requested that 5,000 federal troops be sent to Detroit. During the next several hours, Governor Romney and U.S. Attorney General. Well, let me tell you what happened there.
Okay.
Kavanaugh and I had concluded there was no assurance that we could control it with just the police and the guards, National Guard. After all, the National Guardsmen were not trained for a riot.
Right.
And I walked into his house and found him talking to Humphrey up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the vice president up there. And Humphrey told him he should call Clark. So we called the Attorney General, Ramsey Clark. So I called Ramsey Clark and requested state national troops. And Clark said we'd get them. No, didn't raise any questions at that point. And then you have to keep in mind that at that point I was ahead in the presidential polls of Lyndon B. Johnson, so I was a political a possible political opponent of the presidency. But in any event, Clark said, "Let me read the rest of it." He said, "During the next hour, I'd better run the U.S. Attorney General." Became involved in a controversy over precisely what kind of situation we really had to prevail in Detroit before federal troops could be committed. Well, he started out by saying, yes, you can have them. Then he called back a few hours later, and I'm sure this was after he had conferred with the president, and said they had to have a written request indicating that the riot was completely beyond our control. Now, I consulted with my legal advisor, Danhoff. He said, if you submit a written request of that character, all of the insurance policies in this area will be voided. And so then we began a series of discussions to try and convince them that I could not give them that sort of a... And we finally worked out a compromise written request. I don't remember the exact wording of it. But it didn't negate all of the insurance policies in the area. And they eventually agreed on that basis to send the federal troops.
How long did it take?
It took hours.
It took hours. So that was quite a substantial delay.
Well, it was quite a bit of delay.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, during the next several hours, I'm being brought a controversy over precisely what kind of situation really had to prevail before the four federal troops could be committed. Ron is being advised by his legal staff to officially avoid any language in describing the Detroit orders that would warrant canceling the canceling of insurance coverage in the damaged areas. Clark, on the other hand, was working under federal statutes that limited the circumstances in which federal troops could be used, statutes that required the government to declare the situation in precisely the language he was being advised to avoid. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not about the federal statutes, because the Newark riot occurred before our riot,
mm-hmm.
and President Johnson called the governor of Newark and offered the federal
mm-hmm.
troops,
mm-hmm.
offered to send them in. But in my case, they were insisting that I provide them this statement and so on. So there was a great contrast between
right.
how they handled Newark and how they handled me. And as a matter of fact, subsequently, they studied the question of on what basis the federal troops should be made available if the governor requested them, and they concluded that all that was needed was an oral request from the governor, just what I'd given them initially.
Oh.
So subsequently, they confirmed the fact that this right. holdup was completely unnecessary and unwarranted.
Yeah. Did they give a rationale when they asked you for that written request?
No, they just said they didn't mention any statutes or anything
mm-hmm.
at that point.
They just indicated they
wanted their written request indicating that
mm-hmm.
the thing was completely out of control.
Yeah.
Completely beyond our ability to control. And not only insurance policy was involved, but also we didn't know with certainty whether we could or couldn't. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, at that point. But we had concluded that we shouldn't take the risk
mm-hmm.
of not being able
mm-hmm.
to control it. Because if we'd have done that, why then for the worse. But at any rate, eventually they agreed, and the president sent Cyrus Vance out here in advance with General Throckmorton. And they were sent here and arrived in the early afternoon in advance of the troops. And they were sent to take control of the situation, because you see, the way things operate is that if the mayor asks for the governor and the governor comes in, then the governor's in command.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the governor asks for the national assistance
mm-hmm.
and the president sends somebody in to take over on a national
mm-hmm.
basis, then they are in command.
Oh.
So the men at Vance and Throckmorton arrived, they were in command, and Kavanaugh and I were subject to their decisions.
Mm-hmm.
See, not as the other says. The governor possessed the language of the use of oil at 4:15 a.m. according to Kavanaugh's sudden testimony before the President's Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders. Romney announced he planned a reevaluation of the request of federal troops with key people from the field before relaying his official request to Washington. That is absolutely false. I did not announce any such reevaluation. Let's see. Request did not make until 30 a.m. when telegrams were dispatched to. Oh, now wait a minute. Let me read more carefully. Clark, on the other hand, was working under federal statutes that limited the circumstances in which federal troops could be used. Statutes that required the government to declare the situation precisely when he was being advised to war at 4:15 a.m. Well, that may be correct in light of this request they were making. I mean, I may have indicated I would take another reevaluation of the request for federal troops, because I had to consult with my attorneys and so on,
mm-hmm.
with key people from the field before relaying his final official request to Washington. That request was not made until 8:30 a.m. Well, that was the period during which we were having this problem as a result of Graham and Clark having changed its position and having to work out the fact that we couldn't send him the sort of written request.
Mm-hmm.
He requested. I always felt that they wanted that sort of request so they could...
So you couldn't handle it.
Put the blame on
me.
Right,
right.
And that's what Johnson tried to do in the TV broadcast after the after he set the troops in.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you've ever heard that or not.
Yeah.
I don't have copies of it, but that request was not made until 8:30 a.m. when the telegram was dispatched to President Johnson and Parker recommending we needed 405,000 federal troops. 2 hours later, Romney made public a telegram to the President acknowledging the request and indicating his willingness to send troops. Romney added that he expected the troops to arrive in Selfridge Air Force Base sometime in the afternoon. The troops arrived, but they were preceded by Cyrus R. Vance, President's personal envoy, who arrived at Selfridge Field by 1:20 p.m. Well, actually, he was down at headquarters by that time. And he brought General Throckmorton with him as the man who would be in command of the troops. He was conveyed immediately to police headquarters where he received briefings from Romney, Kavanaugh, Jardine, Colonel Fred Davids, Record State Police, and other officials. The briefings included the critical fact that all personnel resources of the city and state were committed. Air reconnaissance reports at 24 hours west and 6 east of Woodward were still burning out of control. Reports of the moon were still widespread throughout the city. And the urgency of having fellow troops on the street before nightfall. The troops got in here, during the afternoon. I don't know if it was an early afternoon or middle of the afternoon, but they got in shortly after Vance and Throckmorton got here.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, still widespread. Vance then left, the urgent having federal troops on the street before nightfall. The divisions included the critical fact that all personnel resources were still committed to so. Reports of the leaving still widespread and the urgency of having federal troops on the street before nightfall. That's exactly right. Both Kavanaugh and I were urging that they get the federal troops out immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But Vance then left in a 5-car convoy with Romney, with Kavanaugh, Romney, Conyers, and Michigan Attorney General. I was not in that convoy. General Throckmorton and General Throckmorton and Vance went up. I have no recollection that Kavanaugh or Conyers or Kelly were in the convoy that went up. Because what Vance said was he wanted to go out and assess the situation personally before deciding whether to commit the federal troops. So he and Throckmorton went up. And now, this is dinner time.
Time is.
And what happened was the rioters were getting hungry, I guess.
Yes.
And the magnitude of the disorder declined. During the period they were out there. So when they came back, Vance refused to send the troops out. The federal troops. Had them out of Selfridge Field, but he refused to send them out. And now, one of the men you ought to talk to about this is Nichols. The man in the Detroit Police Department that knows what was happening better than anybody else is now the Sheriff of Oakland County here. And Nichols was the man that we were keeping in touch with to get the latest information from the field. But in any event, as a result of that slight improvement, Vance decided not to commit the federal troops.
Mm-hmm.
After the dinner hour, Throckmorton and I were conferring, keeping in touch with Nichols, and the rioting began to pick up again after the dinner hour. And about 9 p.m., it was, I was convinced that the situation was still out of control and that we needed the federal troops on the streets. And Throckmorton was with me when we were talking with Nichols, looking at these figures, and I went in to see Vance at about 9 or a little around that time.
Where was everybody at this point?
We were still in police headquarters. Okay. We were all at the police headquarters. Mm-hmm. That's Throckmorton and Vance and Kavanaugh.
So Vance went out, looked at the scene, and then came back.
And delayed some, mm-hmm. putting federal troops out. So I went in to see him about 9 o'clock, as nearly as I recall the time, and said, look, on the basis of these figures that we have, the situation's still out of control, get those federal troops out in the area rapidly as possible. And he again confronted me with the same request that Ramsey Clark had requested of me in the morning, a written request indicating the situation was completely out of control. So we were right back to where we had the delay in the morning.
A political game.
And I finally said to him, I said, look, if you want to blame this whole thing on me, blame it on me, but get those troops out on the feet in the riot area. And Throckmorton backed up the fact that mm-hmm. the situation was deteriorating. Now, he had an assistant attorney general with him when I met with Vance. I've forgotten his name now, but I guess I could dig it out if he had to, but anyway, he had him. And after I've met with him and indicated that they could blame it on me if they wanted to, but get those mm-hmm. troops out there. I'm sure he went, he didn't say what he was going to do,
mm-hmm.
but I'm sure he conferred with the White House. I'm mm-hmm. sure he conferred with the President. And the President then broadcast about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, I forgot the exact hour, mm-hmm. And in his broadcast, he didn't directly blame me for it, but
he made himself look like a hero.
But in any event, he then indicated he was ordering the troops out to deal with the riot. And they didn't get out until about midnight. Mm-hmm. They got on the field about midnight. And in my opinion, we lost about a day that way as a result of mm-hmm. this inability to satisfy first Clark and then Vance,
mm-hmm.
and the time it took for the President to approve putting the troops on the ground. So that's basically what happened. Now these troops that came in were troops that were good troops. They were trained to deal with situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
They had riot training. Dealt with such activities abroad, so it was very helpful to get them on the field. And once they got out, well, then the situation brought under control.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically it. Now, subsequently, the next day, in talking about what caused this and what might be done needed to prevent a reoccurrence and mm-hmm. to compose relationships in the city, Vance and Kavanaugh and I discussed the creation of a interracial mm-hmm. organization that mm-hmm. might bring the leadership of the community together and establish communication relationships that would avoid a subsequent occurrence of the same type, and that led to our convening a broad leadership group mm-hmm. in the city to discuss the creation of such an organization, mm-hmm. and the leadership of the city thought it was a good idea, and as a result of that, New Detroit was mm-hmm. created, and I was asked to call Joe Hudson and asked him to be the chairman of the first new Detroit organization.
Mm-hmm.
And he served as a chairman.
Mm-hmm. Why was
first chairman?
Why was he chosen?
He was very highly respected.
Mm-hmm.
People had great confidence in him in the city.
Probably seemed like a fair, objective.
Yeah, that's why people viewed him as an objective man of integrity and so on. I thought he was highly regarded by both, all of the elements involved. And he did a good job. I think subsequent events proved that he was a wise choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how New Detroit came into being, as you know, still functioning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And after the ride was over, I decided to scrap a round-the-world trip I was scheduled to make and to visit the ghettos of the country.
Oh, really?
And I visited 17 of them with my
wife.
Is
that right?
From Harlem to Watts. And as a result of that visit to the ghettos, that my current activity is in a way a follow-up. Because when I visited those ghettos, I saw volunteer programs in those ghettos that in most instances were superior to the government programs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And after I dropped out of the presidential race, Nixon came to see me. We had dinner in that house you passed coming in here that I used to live in, that big balcony. And I told him about these volunteer programs. He didn't know anything about them. But he agreed to meet with the people running some of these programs in the country.
Hmm.
And he did meet with them in the summer of 68 during the campaign when I came to Detroit. I'd arranged with the people running some of these programs to be here to inform him about their activities and the effectiveness of their programs. And the result was that when he asked me to serve in the cabinet, he asked me to do two things. He asked me not only to run the department, but also to strengthen this aspect of American society. And I've been working at it ever since. When I was in the cabinet, I convened meetings of these volunteer-dependent organizations. Boy Scouts, United Way, Red Cross, you name it, over 100 of them. And they said, look, we have great programs to deal with specific problems, cancer, heart, and so on. But we don't have any adequate means to deal with our common requirements. And one of the most common requirements is volunteers. People solve the problems. Money doesn't. People solve the problem. And out of that came the organization I'm now chairman of, the National Volunteer Center, was established in February 1970. And we've been working since then to strengthen volunteering activity through the country. And created about 380 local volunteer centers, which is one of the things that's needed. And now Bush has come along with his 1,000 Points of Light program, and I've been working on that. And Bush talked about 1,000 Points of Light. I said, he's talking about volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
So I went right to Washington and helped develop the program that he subsequently announced during the campaign, which included the establishment of a Points of Light Foundation, whose purpose was to involve people voluntarily in community service and so on. And I'm on that foundation board, and we're currently taking a look at how the combined efforts of volunteer and that foundation board, United Way, can be fully effective in encouraging people to become more involved in dealing with these social problems.
Mm-hmm.
I view these social problems that we face in this country so serious, as being so serious, that they threaten the future of this nation as as much, if not more, than the economic failure of communism threatens Russia. And these social problems we face, you start with the deterioration of the family and the widespread promotion of sex outside of marriage and teenage pregnancies and single-parent families and homelessness and hunger and drugs and crime and public education doesn't educate in most instances and the whole and environmental other problems. You take a look at these social problems, and these social problems are not problems can be solved primarily by government money. They're behavioral problems. They're in our local communities. Mm-hmm. And they can only be solved effectively by people helping people. So, right.
Because they're solved by caring.
But sure, the most effective way to help a person who has a problem of alcoholism, drugs, you name it, it's for a caring person to help them to help themselves.
Right.
And there's no substitute for that. And, and furthermore, the cooperative people is the most effective way of solving bigger problems. You take mothers against drunk driving. I spent most of my life in the auto industry. Hello. We're in the process of putting together programs to deal with these social problems. And joining the effort of the organization I have to Endpoints of Light in order to be most effective in dealing. I think I was beginning to talk about being in the automobile industry most of my life. We spend more money as an industry trying to promote traffic safety than any other single thing we spend money on, even though that's a government responsibility. But in any event, along comes this woman with a teenage daughter who's killed by a drunk driver. She says, I'm going to do something about that. She organized Mothers Against Drunk Driving and has done more to reduce traffic fatalities than anything that's happened in my lifetime, any single thing. And then you take the Shrivers. They've organized Special Olympics. That's now the biggest athletic event in the world. They have 1 million volunteers in the world that are helping to put that on. So,
it takes passion.
So the riot played quite a part in my life in terms of shaping my activities since then. And I could give you a lot more background on it, but in substance, that's what's happened.
What do you think? Well, let me tell you a little bit about what the Urban League does and what my own concerns are. The Urban League's programs are often in the area of prevention. In other words,
Anticipating
problems. Yeah. They have a male responsibility program which works with kids in schools and communities starting at maybe even 8 years of age, you know, anticipating their needs and the fact that they probably don't have fathers in the home, etc., to give them the nurturing and substance abuse prevention. And they're working in the homeless area trying to combat or find ways to prevent homelessness rather than dealing with things when they're, you know, they've gone over the edge. One of the things that I see from both my work there and just living in the community is that so many children have no mentors.
That's right. That's
and so many children and youth, they don't have, not only don't they have caring, but they don't have someone who they can emulate. You know, a big sister, a big brother, a mother, a father who, I want to be like you. And that big brother or sister saying, you can do that. And the other thing that I see, and I think they need to be put together, is I see a lot of the yuppies, you know, who don't feel fulfilled. They're successful, they're making a lot of money, but, you know, they don't really have a feeling of being worthwhile. Also, a lot of people today are not getting married. For whatever reason, marriages are not working real well. I know a lot of people into their 30s who don't have children, want children, etc. Well, it seems to me that if there was a good way of putting these people together, so that these successful people could help these young people and work with them, it's a that would be a monumental task to put them together. But one way I wonder if it could happen is I was one of a young men that we work with through my church had an exhibit at a scout. It was a scout whatever at Copa Hall, and we went to see what he did. And they had built a vehicle as part of their scout program. Well, their scout program was inside General Motors. It was the Saginaw division of General Motors and Hamtramck, and the kids actually went to General Motors for their scout program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the people that worked with them seemed very thrilled to have a chance to do something worthwhile, and it was doing the kids immense good because they were getting, they weren't just, you know, building fires by rubbing two sticks together, but they were doing something that could be valuable to them. And I was thinking that combined with this social program, helping them learn how to shake hands and every other thing you need to do in society, it would be a great thing that if that could be a citywide effort.
Well, let me tell you what's happening. What's going to happen? As I say, I've been helping organize the Points of Life Park. There's a Points of Life Foundation that's been appointed. And two of the people on the Points of Life Foundation are Michael Eisner of Disney and Robert Wright, head of NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And they're chairman of a media committee. And this media committee has put together a public service advertising program in conjunction with the Advertising Council. And beginning in February, the people generally through this country will be encouraged to make themselves available to help in programs such as the ones mm-hmm. you're talking about. They'll be given an 800 number to call, and when they call the 800 number, they'll be put in touch with either these the local volunteer center in their area, or if there's no local volunteer center, with the United Way. And they will then be told what opportunities there are for them to use their time and talent in helping in a meaningful way. Now, that's one of the things.
Mm-hmm.
That. Another thing, we're establishing a clearinghouse of information on programs that work, so that what's working here can be known and used elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We're also in the process of establishing stronger volunteer centers through the country. You see, United Way is well organized. The money part of volunteerism is well organized. You got United Way, you got foundations, you
mm-hmm.
got, but the people part is not.
No.
And so, a big part of our effort is in organizing the people part,
mm-hmm.
and that's the part I'm most involved in. And that will result in undertaking to create in communities throughout the country a leadership group whose basic purpose will be to see that these many programs, the type you're talking about, are being conducted
mm-hmm.
adequately in the community,
mm-hmm.
and they can call on this clearinghouse of information on programs that are successful if they have problem areas where they don't know how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this is in process. Now, there isn't any question in my mind but this is the only way we're going to be able to deal effectively
mm-hmm.
with these problems. Now, another thing concerning me a great deal is this. We've got two Detroits. We haven't got one Detroit. We've got the Detroit that Mayor Young is mayor of, and then we've got all these suburban communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been saying for 20 years that the real city is a combination of the legal city and the suburban areas. Mm-hmm. There were mayors who met last week down in New York. I don't know if you read the stories about it. But they said that the suburbs and the central city were one city.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. The real city of Detroit is not just Detroit down in the central legal area. Now, the urban is doing a good job. New Detroit is doing a good job. Hello. Is the fact that while we have a lot of these individual organizations in the Detroit area,
mm-hmm.
we don't have an adequate means of mobilizing the people in the Detroit area and getting the yuppies together with the people down in the central city.
Mm-hmm.
There are people down in the central city that don't have enough help,
mm-hmm.
mentoring of the type you're talking about, tutoring mm-hmm. and so on. And there are people out here in the Oakland County area that would like to help, but they can't help in Oakland County. Well, that's where they need the help.
Yeah.
Now, New Detroit has never measured up to what I'd hoped it would become.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an elite group down there that meets now and then, and basically they've supported Mayor Young's programs or
mm-hmm.
the governor's programs or so on, but they've never really organized to mobilize the effort of the people in this whole real Detroit, which is the suburban,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hopeful Governor Engler is going to try and do something about that. In any event, it hasn't happened, and I brought together Engler and Blanchard before the election on a nonpartisan basis,
mm-hmm.
because this whole effort is nonpartisan. It's
mm-hmm.
not a partisan
mm-hmm.
activity, and with the understanding that whoever won the election or lost the election would continue to work together to give leadership in what I'm talking about
mm-hmm.
here. On a statewide basis, as well as Detroit, so I'm still heavily involved. The riot helped to shape the principal activity I'm
mm-hmm.
now engaged in,
mm-hmm.
in trying to resolve some of these problems
mm-hmm.
that create the riot. And as I said at the New Detroit meeting, the last one I went to, I said, "Look, the problems in Detroit today are worse than they were when we had the riot." Yes, they are.
Yeah.
They are more massive
mm-hmm.
now. They're not as concentrated yet. They'll become as concentrated. You see, what triggered the riot, in my opinion, to a considerable extent, was between urban renewal
mm-hmm.
and expressways, they bulldozed poor black people out of their homes.
Mm-hmm.
They had no place to go in the suburbs, so they had to settle because of the kind of suburban restrictions or whatever. So they settled along 12th Street there, and the concentration of people on 12th Street was too great.
Mm-hmm.
So when that incident occurred, it was just like a spark that ignited
mm-hmm.
the whole area. But on the other hand, the problems in Detroit now are pretty well through the whole city, not just concentrated in one place. It's not, the population isn't concentrated, but the drug pushers and the prostitutes and the pimps and those people are the people in control, and those are the people the young blacks see all the time
mm-hmm.
who've got money and
right.
so on.
Right.
See, so we've got serious problems down there, and I'm hopeful we'll get at them before it's too late. You see, let me just mention another thing. You see, I had to deal with these urban problems. I was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development,
mm-hmm.
and the public housing program that was said to be the best the world had ever seen was built in St. Louis, called Pruitt-Igoe.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of various things, they began to reduce the number of stable families in that big, huge public housing area, about 17 buildings or more. And pretty soon the concentration of problem families became so great, and the murders and the rapes and the other things became so bad that even poor people didn't want to live there. So many of these buildings were empty when I became Secretary of Housing
mm-hmm.
and Urban Development. And poor people didn't want to go in and live in them anymore. And even though we still owed $32 million on those buildings, we knocked them down because they were not being used, because the land was more valuable than all the buildings and so on.
Oh,
now, the same sort of thing's happening in Detroit. The people that can get out of Detroit have been getting out of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
blacks and whites, not just whites.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that the concentration of problem families in Detroit is much greater
mm-hmm.
than it was earlier.
Yeah.
The percentage of problem families
mm-hmm.
within the legal area of Detroit. Mm. So the problems there are worse now than they were when the riot occurred. And I don't know at what point they would get so concentrated well, in any event, I'm deeply concerned. So, look, I gotta go.
Sure.